This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Dr. Willie Parker has committed his life to protecting the health and lives of women through his work both as an abortion provider and through his advocacy on the front lines of reproductive rights. He's the chair of Physicians for Reproductive Health and the recipient of Planned Parenthood's Margaret Sanger Award. In his new book, his wonderful new book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, he offers an unflinching and impassioned analysis of the war on reproductive rights in our country from his singular perspective of Christian faith, hard work, and his firsthand knowledge of the deeply complex and personal decisions that women face every single day about their bodies in this country. Dr. Parker will be in conversation with Katha Paulett. Katha Paulett is the author of 4 essay collections and 2 books of poetry and a beloved columnist for The Nation. Her voice is a crucial part of the feminist conversation, and her 2014 book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, was an urgent call to recast the way that we look at abortion and at choice today. Please help me welcome Dr. Willie Parker and Katha Paulett.
I can't say strongly enough how honored I am to be here to talk to Dr. Willie Parker. He is such a hero and has such an interesting take on abortion in his book, which I hope you'll all read and buy, even more important, Life's Work. It is a terrific book that has just a very unique perspective because, as we'll discuss, it's Dr. Willie is a Christian, and he...
I get the fan guy, too. You have to seize these moments. You don't know how often they'll come around.
I forgot my camera. Can you believe it? I charged it up, and then I left it at home. So... I just want to say I loved this book, and I've read a million books about abortion, and this one is really different. It's more personal. It's extremely well written. It's very accessible. It has lots of fascinating stories in it, and it also has the life of Dr. Willie, which I knew nothing about. So that made it tremendously interesting. So you should all buy a copy of this book. So I want to just have a few questions. We're gonna talk for about half an hour, and then there'll be questions from you people out there. So you begin your book by talking about your patients, the women who come to the clinic to end their pregnancies. And throughout the book, I was so struck by the way you centered the experiences of women. This is kind of unusual in an autobiographical work that you spend a lot of time talking about other people. Usually it's just the writer wants to talk about himself. And it shows that shows up so much in the way you practice medicine. Maybe you could tell everybody what verbocaine is. And the way you honor women's choices. So what would you like people to know about the actual practice of abortion and the women who have them?
Well, what I'd like you to know about the women who have abortions is, if you're female, that they're just like you, that they have the same hopes and aspirations and dreams that you do, and those dreams are being challenged by an unplanned pregnancy. And in the case where it's abortion, it's an unwanted pregnancy, or if it's a desired pregnancy, it's lethally flawed. So I want you to know that they're just like you, and I want you to know that I'm just like you. There's nothing heroic or magnanimous about making the decision to honor another person's humanity. I think when we otherize, it allows us to be less concerned when others are compromised. And I think women in a patriarchal world are born compromised by the control that would devalue them right out of the womb. And so if a woman's most essential destiny is that she becomes a mother, as you talk about in your book, Pro, then it's already an uphill battle. So when I, through my whole journey and my choice as a women's health provider, if I had to summarize why I do what I do, it would be the same way that President Abraham Lincoln responded about why he freed the slaves. Now, there are lots of reasons that the Civil War was fought, but the thing that moved me most when he responded to that question, he simply said, "As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master." And so being born male and a man in a patriarchal world, my challenge is with regard to my humanity was to decide that I would not participate in a process mm-hmm. that would subordinate women solely because of accident of biology. So it's okay. It was a conscious decision to walk through the world awake and to awaken from the fact that the conventional way of understanding my religious tradition, which is very important to me, was inconsistent with what I felt to be the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. The compassion that I felt for women eventually won out, and I had to adjust away from traditional understanding of Christianity to one that integrated the compassion and the integrity and the morality that I felt around women being able to make this decision.
Because your original take on Christianity from when you were 15 and thereafter for quite a while was kind of judgmental, wasn't it?
It was de facto judgmental.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a smug, benevolent judgment
mm-hmm.
Of, you know, the whole God loves the sinner but hates the sin. And you define people by what they do. So I had to divest of feeling superior in any way. I think it was demonstrated most by how I treated my sister.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So when I was 18 in my senior year, I was in deep in my Christian understanding. I was a lay minister and was going around being invited to speak. I at that point was still had not had my sexual debut and had a great deal of pride at being a male virgin. And and lo and behold, my sister gets pregnant at 14 by a buddy of mine. And then I had known other women, other young women who had become pregnant. The earliest I went to school with someone who became pregnant was seventh grade. But when it was my sister, you know, the saying is that charity begins at home and spreads abroad. But for me, it was the converse. I was more charitable towards other young women and understood more. Hey, Francis, that I understood more when it happened to somebody else. It was just unacceptable to me that my sister. And so I realized that while I didn't say anything harsh to her, that she admired me, that I said nothing at all to her was very harsh and punishing of her. And it to this day, I still feel like I'm making amends to undo that injury. There's no malice. We're the closest of my siblings, but I still feel like that is a tab for me in terms of how I practice medicine, because I remember how I treated her, and this is kind of part of my atonement.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you changed your mind about Christianity and abortion?
I had to wrestle. Somebody said when you wrestle with your conscience and you lose, you actually win.
Uh-huh.
And so I spent, after becoming a Christian at the age of 15 and just being going through the traditional understandings and the dogma, I didn't have any explicit teaching that abortion was wrong, but I was... the de facto position was that if a young woman became pregnant, she had to continue that pregnancy. So the kind of moral majority coming to its heyday was after I had made my religious conversion. So we never had that conversation. And so when I became a women's health provider, while I never opposed abortion, I kind of heard the abortion is murder, and I had to wrestle with what it meant for me to provide the care.
Mm-hmm.
And for 12 years as a women's health provider, I was very sympathetic to women, but was paralyzed or unable to act on the compassion I felt. So the epiphany for me came through what to me was tantamount to a religious experience, or almost my born-again experience, while listening to Dr. King's sermon about what made the Good Samaritan good. And it was really a challenge to what it meant to respond with compassionate action to the need of a person. Dr. King describes a traveler who was on the side of the road, injured, and everyone in that community passed that person by. And a traveler not from that community was described as the Samaritan, stopped and helped. And Dr. King said that what made the Good Samaritan good was his ability to reverse the question of concern. And whereas everyone else who passed by said, what'll happen to me if I stop to help this person? Samaritan asked, what'll happen to this person if I don't stop? And in that moment, I saw myself, and I saw all the components of the equation were there. Women needed having a need, me having the ability, or at least being in a position to help, me having to be concerned about what other people thought, particularly Christians, about me as a Christian doing this work. And I had, at that moment, became convinced that it was more important for me to be concerned about the well-being of women than what might happen to me. And so it was really a crisis of conscience bred by a circumstance of, what are you going to do about the injury or about the need that you see? And I was liberated by Dr. King's describing that story, whereas everyone else in that sermon, they hear about the, I mean, I get there with you, it was his last sermon of his life, but I heard in that particular moment a sermon that I heard many times, but finally heard in the context of how am I going to define myself as a woman's health provider.
I was so moved by what Dr. King said, because I never had thought of that story that way either. I always thought of it as a story about, well, first a priest passes by and then a Levite passes by, and you know, they're all virtuous and good, but they can't be bothered. And the Samaritan was a kind of despised person because they had some other religion that I don't really know what it was, but it was different. And he was the one who helped. So Jesus was really saying, you know, what's in your heart, and, you know, all that is what counts, not what you are on the outside, not your social status.
And part of the whole coming from a marginalized, despised group, being a person of color, growing up in poverty in the South, part of my sensibilities around what it means to need help and to have people respond. I described how there were people who, along the way, even though I grew up in abject poverty and had harsh circumstances, along the way, people helped me.
That was such a great part of this book, too, is how it really made me think about how when you help someone, you have to help them all the way. Like, you had people who really kind of guided you to medical school. It wasn't they say, oh, you're smart, you should go to medical school. They showed you how you could get the applications paid for, how you could, what classes to take, where the summer programs were. And I thought it's really complicated to help someone, and how wonderful it was that you found those people, and how you are that person for so many people. So just carrying on the religion theme a little bit, because it's so interesting. You write, and most people have no idea that this is the case, that abortion is not mentioned in the Bible. And this is true. It is really not mentioned. Although I looked at lifenews.net, which is an anti-choice website. I get it. They send me their daily email. So they were very mad at you, because they think abortion is mentioned in the Bible, and that their quotes are weird. Their quotes are very strange. They says, look, God says, before you were in the womb, I knew you. So, okay, so what? You're sitting on a park bench in heaven, and, I mean, you haven't been even conceived yet, and God knows you. That's a little extreme, I think. But so to them, abortion is mentioned, but actually, thou shalt not have abortion. God could have made that very clear, but he did not. So, but why do you think it is? I mean, well, why do you think that is that so many Christians think it is there? Especially since, as you also point out, and this is another fascinating thing, that it wasn't until really kind of the late 70s and early 80s that the anti Christian, I mean, the Christian anti-abortion thing really got going as a political thing. And in fact, before Roe v. Wade, the Southern Baptists had released a letter saying, you know, we should look again at abortion. There's sometimes when it might be the best thing and all like that. And now they would never say that. So what do you think is going on that has made, has fused certain kinds of Christianity with anti-abortion in a way that didn't used to be true?
I think the What's the Matter with Kansas book that came out that kind of explained how you can get people to act against their own best interests. The kind of, if my hand were politics, and the dark side of my hand represented social policy, and the light side of my hand represented fiscal policy, in order to get people to behave against their own best interests fiscally, you move them with social policy by having them think, if they vote for your party, the most essential plank of people who are politically conservative is that they're fiscally conservative, and that they're socially conservative only to the degree that it moves people towards fiscal conservatism. Mm-hmm. So if poor people are moving towards having rich people keep more of their money, the way you get them to do that is you tell them that by voting for you, they're voting against abortion, against gay rights, for tougher immigrant laws. And on the, so they vote for you thinking they're voting for that, and meanwhile, the fiscal policies take effect, but abortion remains legal, and you can't kick all of, you know, and gay people remain gay, and you can't kick anybody out of the country without a due process. So I think we're getting rid of that too. But I think that the ability to get people to short circuit their critical thinking by exploiting the fact that in a world that's increasingly complex, people long for a simpler time, and you promise them that simplicity through revisionist understanding to say, well, you know, since the beginning of time, you know, God has abhorred abortion, but the beginning of time is actually in 1980, you know, on that issue,
yeah.
Right? And so I think it's been the ability to use phrases, cliches, and jingles to short-circuit critical thinking, and that makes people ripe for the longing for a simpler time. People wax nostalgic. And I define nostalgia as when you remember things better than when they actually were,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it really is this desire to be taken care of, mm-hmm. and to long for a simpler time when science and technology have exploded and there's much more information to account for. And people say, I want to go back to the 50s.
Uh-huh.
I don't.
Don't you think, no, me either. Don't you think, too, that there's a way in which when things are changing very quickly, and people have this longing for the simpler time and simpler truths and let's all be fundamentalists, somehow it always comes down to controlling women. That's always a piece of it. And that's very appealing. It's appealing around the world, isn't it? It's not just here.
I say that Eve was thrown under the bus by Adam, and women have been taking the fall for the fall since the fall,
yeah.
Right? So everything is the woman's fault. The first thing Adam said, it was the woman you gave me. She did.
Right. She gave me to eat.
So I think the prevalence of patriarchy exploiting biologic differences and implying that there is a divine order that is instituted based on the accident of biology serves well the power structures that be. And I know in the black church, the tragedy that we have a black church and a white church, that most of the laity are female, most of the clergy are male, and yet as the males rail about the immorality of sexuality, at the same time, in a heteronormative sense, women become perks of power. So the same people who are saying, you know, abortion is wrong, you know, there are women who are there impregnating and exploiting. And so that's not that men can't be trusted with power, but it's to say that those dynamics were created a long time ago. And as we said in the hood, people are saying, don't hate the player, hate the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
So men are, hey, I didn't create it. I just benefit from it.
Mm. So I want to ask you about the I've never seen this either. You compare the denial of reproductive rights to slavery, as these are both ways in which people try to control the bodies and the lives of other people. And then you talk about how abortion opponents are kind of trying to flip that and say, oh, abortion is black genocide. So the slave owners are like women, and the slaves are your fetuses. It's very strange. It's very strange.
You gotta take a hit of this to get that. I don't smoke, just for the record.
So can you talk a little bit about that whole line of thought? Is it effective in the black community, do you think?
Well, it's only effective in terms of that people giving socially desirable answers. You know, the kind of logic is conservative fundamentalist religious leaders use to create what I call the unholy alliance, where they get black people to act against their own best interests. Is to be Christian is to be conservative. To be conservative is to be, even though many black people in general, whether they're religious or not, are socially conservative. But to be conservative is to be politically Republican. So therefore, if you're a Christian, you must support the Republican agenda. And since they've adopted as a plank pro-life, the kind of ability to take sensibilities that are related to being vulnerable, where we do have a shameful legacy of targeted policies to undermine the best interests of black people, to now all of a sudden do what I call epidemiologic mischief, where you take the fact that disproportionately poor women and women of color have higher rates of unintended pregnancy, and abortions come from unplanned, unwanted pregnancies. You take that and then say that there's some conspiracy to kill black babies and black women, started by Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood. It's disingenuous, and it's a really clever Jedi mind trick, because it kind of takes a vulnerable population that can't fend for itself in terms of poor women of color, and then it kind of exploits sensibilities around race. If you say that abortion is racist in a society uncomfortable talking about race, you're not going to get any pushback from providers, most of whom are not people of color, women, most of whom are not people of color, and they're going to panic and try and prove a negative. Am I really racist if I support abortion? Well, it would be racist not to provide those services for people who need them, right? Yeah. So I say it's a Jedi mind trick, because the irony is, if you say that women, poor women, are committing genocide, and you try and force them to continue pregnancies, and then you deny them access to the very human services that would provide a modicum of dignity, both for themselves and their children, it's disingenuous. So what it means is, what you're really trying to do is control abortion by controlling the fertility of black women, and thereby you control the fertility of all women. Paradoxically, you say you want to decrease abortion services, but what you're really doing is you're trying to control the fertility of white women.
Mm.
Why? Because if you're feeling racially vulnerable in terms of with the browning of America, given that by 2050 there will be no clear-cut numerical majority, it will be a constellation of minorities.
I think that'll be so great, by the way. Can't wait. I guess it'll come after.
So if you
come back right after my death to see it.
If you connect the dots, if you're feeling vulnerable around the number of people, or if a white person, if you're feeling vulnerable, that's why you would increase deportation and all of that. What you really want to do is control the fertility of white women, because the only people who can have white babies are white women. White man have a baby with a non-white woman, that baby's not white. White woman has a baby with a non-white man, that baby's not white. Only white women can have babies, white babies with white men. And so if you're feeling racially vulnerable, it makes sense that you would try and control the fertility of white women, because if you believe white privilege has to be preserved, and this was a white country to start and it has to remain one, that makes sense if you see the rise of the alt-right, the mass immigration, deportation policies, and the like. And so in 1904, the politicians were brave enough to say it. Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, white women should have at least two babies or risk racial suicide. Now, you can't say that, well, we're working on it, you know, in terms of the alt-right and, you know, let's make America white again, right again. What happens is you can't attack women who are getting education, running for office, because they're rejecting the primacy of motherhood and having aspirations beyond the model that would allow you to make them the repository of white culture. So I say it's disingenuous at best and it's downright cynical at worst to force people into more misery and suffering. And that's what you do when you deny poor women of color the right to control their fertility. Yeah.
You know, I have one. That was beautiful. It's really good. I just have two more questions because I want to give everybody a chance to ask their questions. My first question is, you describe abortion so clearly as an attempt basically by men to control women. You just cut through the whole, it's about the unborn child and all like that. It's really about controlling women. But what about all those women who were against abortion too? There are a lot of them. And now the anti-abortion movement has become very clever about putting those women to the front. That it used to be, you know, it was all these angry red-faced men being so mean, and now it's all love the sinner, hate the sin. And you see a lot from women. So what do you make of that? What are those women thinking?
Well, I think patriarchy isn't about biology. There are female patriarchs as well. Mm-hmm. And I think they entrench male privilege, because when you benefit from it, there's the concept of meritorious manumission. Like, during slavery, the people who acted in the interest of slavery, they personally were freed, but the institution wasn't overthrown. So there are women who benefit from patriarchy. And I think those women who many times their primary identity of their primary identity being motherhood, and that being fostered as early as possible by a religious understanding that creates gender roles. Wives, be subject to your husbands. The highest mission, the highest duty is to be a mother. And that thinking is more prevalent in fundamentalist religious circles. So mm-hmm. I think it's really easy. You know, female patriarchs are created, and they benefit from the system, and they become the most effective spokespeople for entrenching patriarchy. Just like, you know, the whole notion that a black person can't be racist. Well, if a black person has enough power to be racist, they can be racist against other black folks. So, you know, I think there's a form of what I call meritorious manumission, where, you know, you are free, you personally are freed, and the price you pay is you compromise the well-being of other mm-hmm. people who are similarly situated to what you are.
My last question. You say, with phrases like pro-life and culture of life, the antis seized the moral high ground nearly 40 years ago, and they retain it to this day, because abortion rights activists, people who've been fighting for the rights of women, never mounted a significant religious or moral counter-argument. And you call for a religious, pro-abortion rights stance. And I'm thinking, oh, there goes my book. How can I do this? And you actually, after this quote, you actually are a little bit tweaking of cosmopolitan, atheistical type people who can't really connect. So do you have any advice for people like me who actually don't believe in God and are not Christian? And how can we do a better job of connecting with the people that you connect with?
Well, I think setting the by relinquishing the smugness that non-empiric ways of understanding makes one intellectually soft.
Can you say that again?
That's code for stop calling religious folk crazy, right? The whole notion. So there are some of my colleagues who don't think that I can be intellectually rigorous and have a faith identity. They think that it is compromising of my ability to understand empiric information and process the world in a reality-based way. And I describe it as empiric ways and non-empiric ways of understanding, because myth has taken a really bum rap. Myth has come to mean Santa Claus, but what mythology used to mean was non-empiric ways of understanding in lieu of a scientific model that allowed you to understand why it rained. You would say the thunder gods made it storm, right? Well, that mythology doesn't mean false. It's just a non-empiric way of understanding reality. So I think people who don't use or who don't embrace religious understanding, many of whom have religious PTSD, and so they find people who have religion problematic. I think the first thing to do is to be able to honestly disagree. So when I talk to someone about abortion, or if we're going to have a conversation, people like to come and say life begins at conception. And I'll say, I respect your ability to believe that, but that's a non-scientific understanding of reproduction, right? Mm-hmm. So if we want to have a conversation, we can exchange religious and philosophic ideas about life, or we can talk about a scientific-based understanding. So what that trends towards for me is trying to put it in the realm of having an honest disagreement. Uh-huh. And so with an honest disagreement, I don't lose sight of the fact of your humanity. I'm not going to be disrespectful to you. I'm going to allow you the ability to dissent. But I think the very reason that fundamentalist people don't go into Congress and say, the Lord told me that abortion is immorally wrong, is because they know that that doesn't resonate with folk. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have alternative facts. Uh-huh. And fake news,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's proof positive to me about why facts matter, because if facts didn't matter, you wouldn't have alternative facts, right? Why would you try and fake something that didn't matter?
That's really true.
Right? So it really is incumbent upon us to understand that the truth matters and to be able to say the truth in a respectful way. And when it comes to kind of quieting in the public space, the religious voice that insists on a non-empiric understanding, we have to put facts in that space that we've abdicated. And rather than us having to reconcile with myth and fables and falsehoods, why don't we put facts in there and let them interact and relate to facts? And I think then, rather than us being on the defensive, or not even on the offensive, facts matter. And let's allow them to matter by forcing people to interact with the facts.
I like that slogan, facts matter. That's good. I think probably people really want to ask questions now. This has been such a great conversation, and it's given me so much to think about. Hi.
Dr. Parker, it's such an honor to be here tonight, and thank you for your life work. You're amazing. Would you run for office by any way? That's not my question.
Oh, that would be so great.
It would narrow my constituency too much.
So I have a quick comment and then a question.
Sure.
My favorite aphorism in reference to abortion, and I think it's really true, and I'm not sure who first said it, but if men could become pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament.
Florence Kennedy said
I think that says it all. So that's my comment. My question is, a few weeks ago, there was a law professor from University of Chicago Law School that did a history of the Constitution and gender and sexual issues. But I asked him a question. I said, when Neil Gorsuch was being vetted in the Senate, they asked him his opinion about Roe versus Wade, and he said it's settled law. And that gave me reason to believe that maybe it is. But when I asked that question, the professor said, that's what they're taught to say. He doesn't really mean that. And that the next appointment that Donald Trump gets to make will probably overturn Roe versus Wade. So my question is, could you paint a picture of what that world would look like and how it would affect women, especially poor women?
Sure. What is the term stare decisis? What's that?
Stare decisis.
Okay. I believe that there are people who, when they make it to the court, irrespective of the appointment, I think people, many of them take the law really seriously. And so there are some of my legal colleagues who believe that, you know, in the absence of, that the precedent's been set over 40 years, and that's not lightly. There have been times where they could have, you know, come close to overturning Roe. In 92, they were very close. But that said, what would the world look like? Just try and think back to January 21st, 1973. That's what the world would look like. Pre-Roe, there were states that legalized abortion, and those states are still around, and they will still keep abortion legal. States like Hawaii, New York, California, and some other states that are on board. So what it will mean, though, is it'll be just like 1973, where people's access to abortion will depend on their zip code. And so what'll be different is women will be no less deaf. We already have women right now with restricted access. So even though Roe is in place, functionally, the provisions of Roe have been gutted in many states, many of the states that I practice, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. They make it almost impossible to get an abortion with all the barriers. So it'll be like that, but with instead of being barriers in those states, abortions will probably be outlawed. So that means we'll see what I call abortion tourism. People who can travel will try and get to abortion. They'll get to them safely. I don't think you'll see the return of ethics panels that allowed women with insurance who could justify access to abortion where they could stay in place and get a safe abortion. I think you'll see more do-it-yourself abortion. We'll see unnecessary injury. I think those of us who do this work will have to find a way to provide this care. I think if abortion became, in states where abortion became illegal, a public health principle would be harm reduction. So how people would behave in a state where abortion is illegal may be different from how I would behave in Washington State. But it would, I would, if I were in Mississippi or Alabama where abortion is illegal, harm reduction says that I would feel ethically and morally obligated to give a woman information that would allow her to safely terminate her pregnancy under the principle of harm reduction, like some South American countries. So I think it would be a mixed picture. It will by no means, abortion won't be illegal, but there will, you know, it will, when we see deaths from abortions, it'll be like pre-Roe. There'll be black and brown women and poor women.
Is this on?
Oh, yeah. It is on. Okay. Thank you so much for your talk. I really, really appreciated it. I think it was really insightful. But I kind of want to go back to your last point, what you talked about, conversations between people of faith and people not of faith around really complicated topics. And whenever I see this happen in my own life, it just seems to be a train wreck. It's people just talking right past each other.
Sure.
And you made a really interesting point where it's basically people argue with, say, perhaps scientific facts and scientific realities, and people come at them with religious facts and religious realities. But the one thing that's also really kind of interesting is that, you know, I enjoy reading about Christianity, hermeneutics, and the one thing I found fascinating is you go back 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, pillars of modern Christian political thinking aren't exactly in line, whether it be abortion, homosexuality, evolution. Right. Right. And I kind of, you know, whenever I have conversations about some of this stuff, I sit there and go like, well, you know, before 19 or 1864, the Catholic Church didn't think abortion was a problem, right?
Right.
That's the thing.
Right.
And but I kind of feel myself kind of regressing into the same intellectual superiority argument that just kind of, to be honest, it just makes me feel like a douche, right? Uh-huh. You know, but I kind of want to have a conversation with people, religious people, and bring up religious facts and do it in a way that doesn't make me seem like a jerk.
Sure.
So I kind of want and have an actual conversation, right? So I kind of want you to comment about that.
Well, I think what you make a point about most revisionist history and ahistoric narratives, like people who are still, that has led some people to believe that there has been a, instead of the Civil War being over, that there's merely been a ceasefire, right? And so they do battle reconstruction, say, if we had just done this down in Alexandria, you know, it could have turned the tide. So, but I think, you know, Dr. King said that you should always have opponents and not enemies. And I think the distinction that for me he's making is that how you fight will be determined by how you perceive the person you're in opposition to. When I fought with my brother, I didn't want to kill him, right? I just wanted to restore order, right? But if I but if I fought with somebody that I perceived as an enemy, you can dehumanize that person and you can decimate them. So one of the things that Dr. King said is that what you must always bear in mind is that you must work to defeat evil systems, not the people caught up in them. So if you can, for me, when I see it's going in that direction and this person isn't willing or open, somebody said that when you press on a door that's closed, it becomes more firmly closed. So if you're dealing with somebody and they're not open to honest dialogue and honest disagreement, which Gandhi says is the beginning of progress, shut it down, because the only thing you can do is become like that person in your behavior. And then, you know, an eye for an eye makes us all blind. So I try and set the terms of the conversation. When I'm clear what kind of conversation we're having, when I see that we're not making any traction, I shut it down. Because I'd rather, primum non nocere, first do no harm, is the first clinical axiom that we learn in medicine. And so if a conversation is going to leave you saying, you know, you're ignorant, and leave that person angry with you because of how you engage with them, shut it down. But mindfulness in your conversation, even when you're right, I think, can build social capital that may give you another conversation where that person may get it the next time.
Hi, Dr. Parker. Very appreciative of your work and your care and your visibility. So I'm about to start medical school in August.
We need you.
Thank you. Hopefully OBGYN and be an abortion provider. So I've been thinking a lot about the field that I'm going into and the future of that field and the doctor's role in health justice. So I'm interested in what you think is the importance of doctors in being activists, especially concerning their patients. And do you think there's an obligation there for doctors to be activists due to their position and their privilege in the medical field?
That's a fabulous question, and thank you, and congratulations that you're going to join the ranks. We need you. I think that doctors, as public trust, you know, educations are heavily invested in. It's heavily subsidized. We are resources, but also we are extremely trusted individuals. In Gallup polling, we are the third most trusted individuals. We medaled, but we didn't win the gold, right? The most trusted individuals are nurses, followed by pharmacists, and then by doctors, right? So we got bronze, so we're on the podium, right? But in contrast, the third least trusted people are politicians, right? So it's a topsy-turvy world when people who are making the decisions that affect all of us are given all the power, and those of us, the people who have the most notoriously low voting frequency are doctors, right? So we abdicate our public responsibility. So there's a tremendous amount of responsibility that we hold because we are tremendously privileged and we're tremendously trusted. And so Gunter Grass, who was a journalist, said that the place for a citizen is to always keep their mouth open. We need physicians as trusted individuals to open their mouths about the things that matter. And so when I'm, as the chair of Physicians for Reproductive Health, when we go on the Hill, you know, the lawmakers are excited that we're there. And they say, now, you're sure you're not here to talk about tort reform or improved reimbursement? No, I'm here to advocate on behalf of my patients. And they said, give us the stories we need to move our colleagues. Force us to greatness. Give us the anecdotes we need to craft policy. So physicians have a tremendous responsibility to advocate on behalf of society and their patients, and that's understanding that there are other things besides physical determinants of health. There are social determinants of health, and you can only shape those by going to the seats of power.
Hi, thank you for being with us tonight. So I'm also going to medical school in August.
I do hope lady doctors in the house.
I hope to be an OBGYN, but I'm from Louisiana, and I do hope to practice in Louisiana since it's my home state. So as someone who was raised in rural Catholic South Louisiana, I think it's a little different than the Christianity that you write about because we go back.
Because it's got voodoo in it.
Yes. I acknowledge it's completely the patriarchy, but we at least can go back to the Bible where Jesus founds the church. Peter, you are my rock. On this rock I build my church. And the only thing worse than being a woman is being a non-Catholic. And that's like what my hometown is, how I was raised, a lot of the culture in the Deep South. And so I struggle with, number one, I might not be able to provide abortions in my state by the time I'm a practicing physician, but also it's at the risk of being publicly excommunicated from the Catholic Church, abandoned by my family, and as all abortion providers know, being executed or assassinated. And so what advice do you have for future providers who may be from the Deep South, like you are and like I am, but also are dealing with religious PTSD and our foundations, who are interested in abortion rights and providing all health care for women.
Well, again, congratulations for joining the ranks. And I would say help is on the way. There's increasingly a silent majority. There are people who are not willing to be the first one, but when somebody steps up, they are willing to, not as long as they're not the only one. So what you will find is there are people who are acting out in Louisiana to try and change the policies even as we speak. I'm encouraging my colleagues to not to abdicate their responsibility to advocate for the change that we need to see. And I think you are increasingly having the demand from women to have these services available. I'm encouraging women to screen their provider based on whether or not that person is willing to provide. So if you, people are competing for your dollars, right? So if you go to somebody and say, okay, you, I like your practice. Now, we both know that contraception is not 100% effective. How will we manage an unintended pregnancy? If that person says to you, I will take care of you and I will provide care for you, that's somebody to consider. If that person says, I don't do abortions, but I have indexed in my files, I will get you into care, that's somebody to consider. If somebody says to you, I can't help you with that, I don't do that, and I wouldn't help you with that, then that person doesn't deserve the right to care for you. So we're encouraging, if women did that, there will be a demand from the public, and doctors chase dollars, right? So I would say don't dismiss the possibilities of what's happening on the ground where we come from, because there's a beast that has been awakened. And when we can arouse that beast, and you know, when you come back, I'm trying to get people who have a sense of place about where the need is. I would say to you, though, to listen to your heart, because the need is not the call, right? Just because you're from there and you know what the dire straits are, if your sense of mission isn't pulled by, you know, the fact that that feels like the right thing for you to do, give yourself some space to make that decision. You may not want to go home right away. You may decide at a different stage in your life, or you may decide that's not for you, but you should never abdicate your responsibility to advocate for gender justice, in particular women having control over their lives and their bodies.
Thank you. Hi, so I'm sticking on the medical theme.
Are you a medical student too?
No.
Okay.
But anyway.
Sure.
I'm a patient.
Works.
I have an IUD.
Yay! Thanks for sharing.
I don't know. I just wanted to feel cool, like all the medical stuff. Yeah.
If I had a uterus, it'd have an IUD in it.
Anyway, so she kind of took my question, but just thinking about like, abortion is politicized, but it's a medical procedure, and that medical need, and where we think of do no harm, like where it flows from that. So where do you see the obligation of that doctor who says that they won't provide? I know we can say it's the religious freedom and the religious right, but could you talk about either your position on that or what you were taught in school and how that might differ now about abortion? Because kind of heard that maybe it's just not taught as well it should be taught, and that's why we don't have enough providers who understand maybe how to even do abortion, or even how we could promote like increased scope of practice for nurses who could help provide in areas where there's not doctors who are providing that. Because we see that with like dental therapists, the American Dental Association is pretty vehemently against like kind of pulling dental therapists, like kind of lower provider, not lower, but you know, like less skilled providers in providing care. So kind of where you see also maybe the movement of physicians for reproductive health, like advocating for scope of practice if they're not going to increase doctors.
Well, as long as I'm the chair of Physicians for Reproductive Health, there will be unbridled advocacy for an expanded scope of practice. Mm-hmm. Because like George Tiller said, abortion is not a matter of your terminal degree, it's a matter of the heart. Mm-hmm. So why should we be creating entitlements to provide abortions for people who are not committed and willing to, i.e. saying only OBGYNs can provide abortions, and then denying people like family medicine docs who train to provide abortions, saying because of your specialty, you're not capable. Mm-hmm. So right now we're in the final phase of fighting a specialty requirement in Mississippi that says you have to be a board certified OBGYN. What that will open up to is non-OBGYNs being able to provide abortion care if they are trained and skilled. And I have colleagues in California who are nurse practitioners and other types of practitioners who are trained to provide abortion care. Let's go back to the Jane Project in 1973, where when abortion was provided by laywomen under the tutelage of doctors because they learned how to provide abortion care. So it's not as much a matter of this as it is this and this. Mm-hmm. And so we have to stop allowing people to, under the guise of safety, restrict the providers who can provide this care. I think to kind of encourage you that there are providers in the pipe. There are programs where there's a demand at the grassroots level of people who do reproductive justice. At the undergrad level, aspire to medical school. They become members of Med Students for Choice, and then they go to schools where they are insisting that they get training in abortion care. The regulatory bodies of medical education are considering abortion care core competency, and so there, the pipeline, we are now finally dropping the average age of abortion providers, so we're retarding the graying of abortion providers by new people entering into the field. So help's on the way. It's not as dire as you think, but we've got to continue to build capacity. I think our next challenge is, how do we distribute that resource? Most people, when they want to be safe, so they want to stay in San Francisco after they train versus going to Natchitoches, Texas. So it helps there. We got to distribute it, and you have to make that demand from as outside of medicine to say that this is care that we deserve and we want.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. You're up.
Hi there, I'm Short. First off, go blue. I'm from Grand Rapids.
Go blue.
My question for you, I don't have a medical background, but I do have an ethics and philosophy background, and over the years, I've just really become obsessed with the issue of abortion rights and ethics and that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering, through my field work with as a volunteer and that kind of stuff, the conversation of ethics is often met with resistance in the pro-choice community, at least in my experience. And I'm wondering if the pro-choice community needs to reclaim ethics, to reclaim the conversation around abortion, and I know pro kind of discussed that, and so I was wondering that opinion.
You know, I would be a fool to forego expertise that I have right here to speak to that. Frances Kissling, that's her work, that's what she does, and if you will come up and speak to that.
Thank you very much. I think that what is often eschewed, and I've been thinking a lot about the exchange between you and Casa around people who disagree and the idea of non-empirical knowledge and empirical knowledge, which touches also on the question of ethics. I think you have much less of a problem in the choice movement when you talk about ethics than when you talk about morality. Okay? The reality is that ethics and morality are exactly the same thing. They're just two words. One comes from a Latin root, one comes from a Greek root. One is a hot word, morality. One is a cool word, ethics. But they're really, really the same thing. And I think the resistance is more around the moral word than it is around the ethics word. But I think a lot more work can be done in the area of ethics within the movement itself. And it goes, and what I want to say is, it goes, I wasn't going to get up and say this, but as long as, you know, I was going to just, all right, let them all talk, you know, who cares, you know, kind of thing. But I think that this point that you were raising about a non-empirical way of looking at the world, as opposed to an empirical way of looking to the world, I was not totally comfortable with your response, because I think you actually went right back into polarity. Okay, you respected the person who thinks non-empirically, but then you told them that, well, they really have to go to facts, you know, and it's facts that to some extent have contributed to the failure of the pro-choice movement in many ways. Most people don't decide things they consider to be heavy issues on the basis of facts. They decide them on the basis of their values. And ethics is about values. And it's about more than values, but it's definitely about values. And so to try the trains colliding or the trains going in separate directions are when we try to convince people that they should think about abortion in a factual basis. Abortion is merely a medical procedure. Okay, for example, it's not merely a medical procedure for people who live their lives in deeply felt value systems. So, Willie, and I'm sure that you probably agree with me. what we have to do is learn the language of values. You're not going to convince people of something where they disagree with you, and we're not talking about hardcore, we're talking about softcore disagreement. You're never going to convince them by presenting them with the facts that we've been presenting them with for, 45 years now. You're going to have to convince them by entering their moral sphere, and this is the work I do internationally, by the way, entering their moral sphere and finding ways to talk to them about the values that are important to them, not the facts that are important to us.
Thank you. I see you. One of the, just to chime in, one of the, in terms of the, as people modulate, Dr. King said, science gives mankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives mankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies. And the real challenge is to break down that false partition. People don't make, as you said, Francis, they don't make purely empirical decisions, and they don't make purely emotional ones. And yet, Dr. King also said, the heart can never be right if the head's totally wrong, and the head can never be right if the heart's wrong. So one of the things that I'm hoping for, is rather than a more civil discourse, is more honest disagreement, where if your objection is philosophical and religious, and I don't have a religious frame of reference, I should be able to say that to you in a respectful way, and vice versa. Because ultimately, how we're going to arbitrate what we're going to do as a society is a political decision. And so my goal is to make sure that no particular philosophic or religious perspective is in the ascendancy over the scientific understanding of reproduction. When most philosophic and religious understandings are not scientific, is to say, okay, if you say to me that man was created first, and then from his rib, a woman was created, the default template in biologic development is the template is female, and in the absence of male hormones, the de facto is female, so males couldn't have been made first, right? That's not a scientific understanding. So I'm saying you've got to modulate between the two. And it really comes, if we're going to have honest disagreement, it's like, how are we going to navigate those conversations? These are dinner conversations that Francis and Catherine and I are going to have a lot more of. But thank you for raising the question.
Thank you. Hey, it's just me. We have time for two more questions.
Okay, great.
No pressure. I wanted to speak to, in volunteering and doing some of this work, as I have, the encounters that I'm sure you've had and many others in this room, folks who you encounter a lot outside of clinics with mm-hmm. their signs and petitioning. And there are instances sometimes, as one in three women in their life find, where they have an unintended pregnancy, and suddenly that person comes inside for a little while. Mm-hmm. And has to make tough choices. How can we on the pro-choice side say it's okay to change your mind on this and kind of welcome people into the fold? Because I've seen that not always happen. And then what is your response when that person goes right back outside and the only moral abortion was mine because I really needed it, mm-hmm. and then continues to this? Well, it's sort of a two question, yeah, but I hope we have time for one more.
I hear you. The one of the things that I'm clear about, as I said earlier, what Dr. King says, make sure that you work to deconstruct evil systems, not the people caught up in them. I think many people, you know, the unintended pregnancy does not stratify by how you feel about abortion. Women who are firmly against abortion have unintended pregnancies. In fact, the women who cry the hardest are the people who've never thought that they would be on my table, right? And so what I try and do is I try to model the compassion and encourage my colleagues to have compassion. A woman who is deeply fundamentally opposed to abortion who's on my table is not a hypocrite. She is someone who has to understand that none of us know ourselves well enough to know how we will behave until we're in a given situation. So what I hope for her and what I try and discuss with her is I hope that you'll gain that insight. And even if you decide to go back on the outside, that you will, it may be harder for you to criticize and to judge and to harass somebody. But like you said, many of them, you know, everybody has three indications for abortion: rape, incest, and mine, right? And you know, whatever mine is also a legitimate. Okay, so I try to make sure that my colleagues don't exclude those women from care, because when I fight for abortion care, I'm fighting for the right of the person who's fighting against me. And I fight that no one is denied the access to achieve their reproductive outcome. And so I say compassion, not only for women who are stigmatized and shame, compassion even for women who are caught up in a system that leaves them oblivious to their biologic reality as a sexually active woman.
Hi.
Okay,
it is such an honor to be here. You were talking about, you know, it being okay if it was yours or whatever. So, I mean, I've always been grew up in a Christian household. I still am religious. But the moment that I thought my contraception didn't work, I was like, I'm pro-choice. Like, it's just done for me. So I sometimes struggle with communicating to my Christian friends or my Christian family about the moral argument for being pro-choice and articulating that well. And you made a comment earlier about how sometimes you feel like the pro-choice movement hasn't really articulated that well. And we've talked a little bit about values. I was curious to know, in your conversations with other Christians and religious people, is there a particular approach or value or argument that you've made that seems to resonate the loudest with other Christians?
I think it's been more my approach to say, you know, let's agree to honestly disagree, and I will never lose my respect for you. Yeah. You can tell me that you don't believe that I'm a Christian, but I'm never going to question yours. So I think it's more the approach of how you engage. I think that's been most essential to me. And so even when I'm insisting that we have a scientifically based conversation mm-hmm. about reproduction, mm-hmm. I don't bam, now take that, right? It's more let's have an honest conversation. Mm-hmm. Help me understand what you mean when you say this. Here's what I mean when I say that.
Yeah.
And then allowing that person to leave with their dignity. I'm reminded of there was a passage where there was a man who came out. I think he was talking to Paul, or one of the Christians who was making the case for Christianity. And the man left. He said, "You almost persuaded me to be a Christian." And what it meant was that there was honest dialogue and there was give and take. But at the end of the day, that person was left free to make up their own mind.
Right.
And I think I'm not of the impression that I can convince anybody of anything.
Yeah.
I can expose you to thoughts. I can give you more questions when you thought you had more answers, mm-hmm. but it's not my job to convince you. The only person who can open your mind is you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have I've got to win. It's more, let's have an honest disagreement. Let's have an honest conversation. And if we disagree, let's do that in mutual respect. And I think you get more traction that way. And you really can't be vested in what they end up with, but just that the conversation was thoughtful.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you all very, very, very much. Thank you to Catholic Pollard, right?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.